You hear oral argument from petitioner in Texas Department of Transportation versus Barber.
May it please the court, Mr. Rick Thompson will present argument for the petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
In declaring the Texas Highway Beautification Act unconstitutional as it applied to Mr. Barber Sign in this case, the Austin Court of Appeals not only failed to apply the proper time, place, and manner analysis to this content-neutral regulation, but also issued an improper advisory opinion. When Mr. Barber took his sign down before any Texas court ordered him to do so, the constitutional issues that were presented in the case were necessarily rendered moot. The Court of Appeals did not have jurisdiction to issue its opinion or its judgment, and that's why we're here asking this court to vacate the judgment and opinion of the Court of Appeals and dismiss this case as moot. On November 4, 1999, Mr. Barber took his sign down voluntarily. It was not until 3 weeks later.
Was he being fined at the time?
Not at all, Your Honor.
Was he subject to a fine?
Hypothetically, but when the department had moved and counterclaimed for enforcement, they did not seek a fine.
But they could have sought a fine, correct?
They could have sought a fine.
And can the fine be related to how long the illegal sign is there?
It can, Your Honor, but I don't think that's the type of collateral consequence that takes it out of the mootness doctrine, especially since, in this case, he removed the sign 3 weeks before the court said that they found the document.
Well, but let me make sure I've got this right. He's either faced with taking it down, either leaving it up and subjecting himself to an ever-increasing possibility of a fine, or taking it down and mooting the controversy. Is that right?
He is subject to a fine, Your Honor, if the state moves for it. He wasn't being subjected to a fine. He knew that. He could have waited for the trial court to rule. He could have asked the trial court to suspend its judgment pending his appeal. There are a number of things he could have done. He didn't. And, in fact, there wasn't even an enforcement action until some 6 months later. It was only in May of 1999 that the enforcement action went forward in the trial. That's when the court said, you cannot show your sign. But she didn't say take your sign down. Instead, she took her pen and she went through the language in the proposed order that said you must remove your sign, because even she recognized that the sign had already been removed.
Wouldn't a declaratory judgment action still have been proper and not moot? I mean, couldn't he have taken his sign down and then moved for a then sued for a declaratory judgment saying it was okay for him to put his sign up?
He didn't do that in this case, Your Honor. And
judgment action piece of this case.
Yes, Your Honor, but he had already removed his sign before the judge.
I understand, but even if a sign were not up, that would not moot an action under the declaratory judgment statute.
If he removed it before there was a ruling on the declaratory judgment?
I'm just saying that if someone sought, either the state or Mr. Barber sought a declaratory judgment to whether or not the placement of that sign would violate the act, or wouldn't that then keep the action alive regardless of whether he took the sign down?
I think not, Your Honor. Your Honor, this is content neutral because the statute is not aimed at any message in any particular billboard. What it does is it tries to get billboards off a narrow corridor of the highway. It's a valid time, place, and manner restriction. To decide whether it's content neutral or content based, which the Court of Appeals didn't even decide in this case, there are two primary things that courts look at. The first is whether or not the statute is viewpoint discriminatory. Mr. Barber admits in this case that this statute is not viewpoint discriminatory. The other thing that people look at, courts look at, is the justification for the statute, whether the statute is aimed at suppressing an idea, altering the debate on a public issue, or whether the statute is really aimed at the secondary effects of the vehicle for the message that is conveyed, like billboards. And that's exactly what we have in this case.
The respondent cites a case out of the 11th Circuit called Southlake versus Morrow, and they quote from that saying that the court seemed to have some some concern about road signs, the positions of courts saying that as long as the sign is related to what activity is going on the property, there, of course, have said, well, that's not content-based restrictions, and that's reasonable, and as long as they don't distinguish between commercial and non-commercial, that's okay. The 11th Circuit seemed to express the concern that ideas don't have locations. And so to say that as long as it relates to the property, that's not content-based discrimination, they say, is kind of false reasoning, because ideas don't have locations. So why isn't one that requires the sign to be related to an activity on property really unconstitutional as relating to content, because, in fact, ideas don't have locations?
Your Honor, I don't think it's content-based. The Metro Media case addressed that. They also said there could be off-site, on-site. And I think the reason is the justification for allowing a sign where there is already a business in place.
I guess Metro Media declared the sign ordinance unconstitutional because it distinguished between commercial and non-commercial. There hadn't been a Supreme Court case that has fleshed out ordinances that require signs to be related to activities on the property.
They did with respect to commercial properties in Metro Media. They said that that was perfectly okay. They made that distinction. And one of the reasons that it is okay is the legislature can say, well, there's already a business in this place. It's very similar to the exception for commercial and industrial areas. If this area has already been blighted with a building or has a commercial venture ongoing at that location, then a billboard is not going to make that big a difference. They can say that it's all right to have a smut sign in that place. Also, it allows the business to identify itself as the business that's ongoing on that property.
In your brief, you say that this is not content-based because if it's a car mechanic on premises, they could put a sign that says, recycle your oil. If it's a church on the premises, you could say, Jesus is Lord. Well, if it was not a Christian church, if it was a non-Christian denomination church on the property, could the owner of the property, who may not be the same person as the church that occupied the property, put a sign up there and say, Jesus is Lord? Would that be permissible under the sign ordinance? Is that related to the activity on the property?
So the property owner and the ongoing activity are two different people?
Right.
No, Your Honor, I think the sign could only relate to the activity that's going on the property.
And so the state would be interested in the content of the message in order to determine whether or not it has to do with the activity on the property.
It would have to read the content. It would not be aimed at promoting the content or suppressing the content. It doesn't care what the content is so long as it's related to what's going on.
But what happens if the auto mechanic doesn't recycle oil, but the auto mechanic puts a sign up that says recycle oil? Then is that sign permitted or not?
It is related to what's ongoing on his property, yes, Your Honor. That is permitted. He doesn't have to agree with the sign that he puts up as long as it's related to the activity that's going on
his
property.
So does the state get itself involved in what... In whether the message is... does the state start differentiating between a message that supports an activity and a message that's contrary to an activity, or a message that is tangentially related to an activity?
There's nothing in the record to support it, Your Honor. All I know is that it has to be related in some way.
You say the state doesn't care, but there are repeated assertions in the respondent's brief that this is selective enforcement, and no response in the reply. Is there a response?
Yes, Your Honor. The selective enforcement case went forward in the trial court and was denied by the trial court, was not appealed to the Court of Appeals, nor this court. I don't think it's properly before this court. Those allegations should have been sought or carried forward with that cause of action. I don't think whether a statute in one particular instance is unconstitutionally enforced or selectively enforced affects the constitutionality of the statute as a whole or as it is applied.
Finding by the trial court, or how was this resolved by the trial court?
The trial court denied the selective enforcement claim. Yes, Your Honor. It's in the record.
You talk about the You talk about Mr. Barber having an opportunity to make his expression somewhere else in some other way. Does the record show how close, how far away the nearest location that was either commercial or had circumstances like commercial where he could have purchased a sign?
It does not, Your Honor. There was not an evidentiary finding about where the next appropriate place was that he could put a sign. He could have put his sign in any commercial or industrial area.
But we don't know if that's 1 mile or 50 miles.
No, Your Honor. We don't. It's not reflected in the record. But I think it's probably very close, and besides that, it doesn't have to be on the federal highway. This statute is so limited. It's limited to 660 feet.
Well, if the Mitchell County officials are making illegal searches on Interstate 20, then it's not going to do much good to have that sign on a farm-to-market road as far as interstate travelers are concerned, is it?
It would be effective in the commercial area just before or just after.
But you just told we don't know. I mean, the just before or just after may not even be in the county or in the locale of the jurisdiction that the officers are active in.
And there are two responses to that, Your Honor. I think there are plenty of other alternative avenues available. He can have public forums. He can send letters. He can do lots of things. He can put his number at his law office. The other thing is that I think we're assuming that he has a right to display and advertise to the traveling public as it travels along I-20. And I just don't think that is the case. The First Amendment does not give someone the right to direct a particular message to a particular group of people.
I was asking questions about your argument that he had that right because he could put up this information someplace else. So I was just trying to find out where that other place
I don't know where that
would it be effective for his purposes?
I don't know where that is, Your Honor.
But you say there's no right to direct a message to a particular group of people, but if you can't direct some messages to the group, the message does no good. I mean, it wouldn't do. Assuming that the attorney in this case is concerned about searches and seizures on Interstate 20, it wouldn't make any sense to put that sign up in his law office or hang it in the alley or on some other road, because those people wouldn't be the ones to whom the message was directed.
Your Honor, I just don't think that he has a right to the most effective or the most cost-effective method of getting his message over to his intended audience. He has a number of alternative methods of reaching these people, and that's all that the law requires, other avenues available. The main objection to the statute has been the political sign exception, and I think that's not a problem at all, because it's so narrowly tailored to address a particular problem that the legislature should be permitted to do that. It's a very small sign. It can't be over 50 square feet. It has to be before 90 days and within 10 days after removed. Not even Mr. Barber's sign, if it were a campaign sign, would fall within the campaign sign exception.
Justification. You seem to argue in your briefs that there are three bases that the state can justify this on. One is beautification, keeping billboards from cluttering up rural areas. Two is safety. You say it's dangerous for people to be looking at signs while they're driving 70 miles an hour. And three is the federal funding. With respect to the first two, isn't that undercut by the fact that the state does not have these regulations in the vast majority of rural highways in the state?
Your Honor, I think it's perfectly tailored to that because it's perfectly logical for the legislature to think that the high traveling traffic on the interstate highways that are federally funded should be protected from these large distracting signs.
Well, you can drive 55 miles an hour through Temple, Texas, and there are signs up all over. I mean, where's the safety value there? And there are other highways in Texas that I assume are not federally funded, where people travel at high speeds in great numbers, and the state does not have these restrictions. So is that really a valid justification?
No, Your Honor. I think it just shows how very narrowly tailored the law is and how it is directed at one particular harm. I don't think that we can say just because they're not aiming at safety on rural highways, that doesn't mean that they aren't aiming at safety on federally funded, highly traveled fast highways.
Let me ask you this. It'd be pretty easy to remedy, wouldn't it? I mean, if he were to pull a small mobile home, for example, or trailer onto this property and put up a law practice sign, the sign would be okay.
Exactly.
Under the statute.
Yes.
Well, then how is the secondary effects analysis? Well, How is that served by this sort of arbitrary distinction?
May I answer, Your Honor?
Mm-hmm.
I think that it's just served because they have decided that if there are businesses ongoing on a location, there are already distractions. It's more like a commercial industrial area, not a beautiful area that takes away from the scenic value and the aesthetic value of the highway, and wouldn't be any more distracting to the traveling public than would the trailer with the sign that
says
law.
Well, it's hard for me to see, though. I mean, in reality, if it's outside the 660 parameters, but still prohibited because it's visible, I can easily see a scenario where you couldn't see the office that was located there, but you could still see the sign, but that would be okay.
Yes, Your Honor, and I think we have to take it into bigger picture. Instead of saying this one sign might be distracting, is to consider the 41,000 signs that had been removed as of July 1998 under this particular act to show that it really is aimed at clearing out the highways and making it more safe. And
well, let me just—he could also keep the sign up if on the sign he put, "So vote for so and so."
No, he couldn't, Your Honor.
Well, he could do it temporarily.
No, he couldn't, Your Honor. It's too large.
On the same property, he put up a small structure that had, you know, come here for a copy of the Constitution of the United States dealing with the Fourth Amendment. Then the sign would be okay.
I think, Tank, it would be a lot closer, Your Honor.
So, I mean, we're really dealing with, I mean, what's the fundamental complaint that you have here? It seems like there are so many vast ways around the restriction that the statute almost makes no sense.
It does make a great deal of sense. It's been very successful, Your Honor. The problem is, with this very unique fact scenario and the rights implicated, we're going to have an unconstitutional as-applied challenge. It's going to be in the Austin Third Court of Appeals. Austin is where TxDOT is located. All the cases will be brought there. The one person across the street from the person who puts up the abortion is murder sign will put, you have the right to have an abortion. The next landowner will put, abortion is murder. The next one will put, you have a right to abortion. There will be a million political signs back along the highway, and that will jeopardize the aesthetics, the safety,
but I'm saying,
and the federal
but
funding.
With each one of those signs, if you put up a building that has a copy of Roe versus Wade, then it's okay.
If it's a it'll basically, that would become a commercial and industrial area, Your Honor, and those are excluded in order because the safety values are not as important. And when the government weighed their right to put up a sign for their ongoing concern against the government's interest, the landowners prevail.
But then that becomes the problem of Metro Media, where the prohibition really applies to ideas as opposed to activities. And so, as you said, if all I have to do is get around this billboard expressing an idea is I erect a building and put the Constitution in it, it becomes more like a commercial enterprise. And didn't that beg the question?
I can say that hasn't been a problem. The state has not seen a flood of folks putting up buildings in order to erect billboards to make non-commercial statements.
If the state statute has this infirmity, does the federal statute have it as well?
The federal statute has 6 of the 7 exceptions. They're mandated by the federal statute. The only thing that's different is the campaign sign, and that was done in reaction to a civil rights complaint that people wanted to be able to express it. So we went to the federal government, asked for a very limited exception, worked it out with them, had it approved in order to not jeopardize the federal funding, and that's how it was approved.
No, is if the state statute is infirm, as the third court held, is the federal statute likewise infirm?
I think our statute actually permits more speech under the First Amendment. I suspect that it would be.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court, Mr. James Harrington will present argument for the respondent.
Good morning, judges. When our founders sat in Philadelphia a couple of centuries ago, in the steamy summer, in a room not unlike this, and drafted what became the greatest Bill of Rights that had ever been put on paper, the issue in front of them, when it got to the First Amendment, is the issue in this case, and that is the right of a citizen to make political commentary using their own property.
I think you have acknowledged the benefits of this type of act. Could you describe for me a state statute that would pass constitutional muster under your analysis?
The state can very easily say, enact a reasonable time, place, and manner law that would allow political speech on private property.
Give it to me.
Every citizen will be allowed, or every citizen will have the right to use political, to put a political message on their property, so long as it's no larger than 16 feet wide and 8 feet high, for example.
Well, so then if everyone did that, you'd agree that that could bump up against the purpose of the act, which is to promote safety. I mean, my understanding is you've stipulated that there are good and fair purposes that the act is intended to promote.
Good and fair practices do not always trump the First Amendment.
So you'd say there really can be no limitations except for size, and that would be it.
No, I hope I did not imply that. I just use that as one example of a reasonable time, place, and manner. I think you could also arguably say that maybe one sign per lot, for example. Different variances of that. You know, as we do right now with the political signs, for example, they have to be a certain size to fall within the TxDOT variance.
So
that sort of stuff is what I'm talking about.
So you would say the ordinance could say one sign per property owner, even if they owned 100 acres. One sign. One size. I mean, I understand your criticisms of it. I think it's probably easier to pick apart a statute than it is to craft one that would pass some sort of test that would... You think?
At least, Judge, in the scenario where you can put one billboard on your property, at least you have free speech. Right now, you can't put any billboard on your property. Right now, you have no free speech. So the only argument then becomes, is this limitation on free speech that can be exercised, is that a reasonable place, time, and manner restriction? Is one per lot enough or two per lot? But at least... Even if a state said you could have one, at least you have free speech. And this argument now, you have none.
You have none. You say this is political when the attorney is advertising his telephone number. Why isn't this commercial?
I'm sorry, Judge. I didn't hear advertising what?
Why do you say this is political speech when the attorney is advertising his telephone number? Why isn't this commercial speech?
It's because the telephone number is merely to pick up. The message. It's not a...
The message says, call me and hire me if you need me.
Say hire me.
Well,
but if it did, your case would go away, wouldn't it?
I mean, if that phone number said, if you're having problems being harassed, hire me, I'm a great lawyer, then that would be this would be commercial speech, wouldn't it?
It would be commercial speech, but it would not be... permissible in that location because his office was not on that piece of property.
But if he had a little kiosk under there...
Yeah, the kiosk, yes.
Then it would be... I mean, it would not cost too much to make this case go away from your standpoint.
Well, the burden isn't on the plaintiff to incur the cost to exercise free speech. And I don't know what counsel was talking about. It may be that he wasn't familiar with the trial. But there is already a $1,200 levy on Mr. Barber.
But what I'm concerned about is the Court of Appeals said, well, as to commercial, non-commercial speech, we think this statute's okay. But because this is ideological speech, political or whatever you want to call it, different from commercial, non-commercial, we think that the statute is infirm for that reason. But you can't just put a sign up that says, I believe in the First Amendment, eat at Joe's. I mean, it seems to me that's clearly commercial speech, at whatever dressing you add to the rest of the sign. And I'm wondering why a sign that advertises a lawyer's telephone number isn't more commercial speech than political or ideological or whatever.
Well, Judge, it wasn't a telephone number to his office that you could call up and talk to him. It was a telephone number to a pre-recorded message.
But that was you could get the lawyer from that message, as I recall.
Yep. Pat Barber.
I'm not clear from your briefs. Are you relying solely on the First Amendment, or are you also making an equal protection argument?
There is an equal protection component in the First Amendment. So we basically, we did not specifically argue equal protection. One thing I would like to mention, too, with respect to the brief, is that we did make a state constitutional argument also with regard to the first the free speech jurisprudence of this court. Counsel said, of course, you just can't create a greater right because you want to, which we agree with, and that's certainly the position of this court. But we also mentioned Ex parte Meckel, which was a decision by the Court of Criminal Appeals in 1920, finding that political speech in Texas had greater protection under Section 8, Article 1 than was afforded by the First Amendment. And in the First Amendment, this case involved disloyalty acts, federal and state. Under the State Disloyalty Act, Meckel was eventually freed by habeas corpus. He was convicted and freed by habeas corpus. Under the federal habeas...
That was a prior restraint case.
Yes.
Much like Davenport and some of the others where we've talked about greater rights.
That's exactly right. It was a prior restraint case, but it was a political speech. On the rehearing opinion, it was very clear that the Section 8 is designed to protect political speech. But it is, you're quite correct, it's a prior restraint. But it does talk about Section 8 offering the kind of political speech protection that obviously is greater than offered under the First Amendment, because Eugene Debs was jailed a year earlier under the Federal Disloyalty Act, which was identical to the State Act. So we're not asking you all to create a greater standard ex nihilo in this case, but I think it's certainly consistent with the tradition of the Texas courts with regard to political speech and the protections offered by the Section 8.
Do you agree with opposing counsel that your selective enforcement argument has been waived?
No. I'm at a total loss to understand what he's talking about, frankly. I really don't know what he's talking about. It's not... this was decided on cross motions for summary judgment.
A later finding of no selective enforcement.
I'm going to go back and look, but I can tell you I do not remember that. I do not remember that. And there was a lot of evidence put into the record about that there had been signs up there, a whole slew of signs in that area, some 10 years old. That the state had never taken an action.
Did you pursue that argument in the Court of Appeals? Did you pursue the selective enforcement component of your
Yes, case? We argued that.
In the Court of Appeals?
We did argue that, and the court didn't really touch it. But we did argue that.
You make this argument in your brief several times, but you don't have any legal discussion when you're talking about this argument. Is the law just not out there, or you thought we'd know it by memory?
Well, I was obviously I clearly thought you would know it by memory, but it wasn't. I think in our view that the First Amendment law is so clear that this really decides the case.
Well, suppose we get confused on the First Amendment. Can you give us some law about selective enforcement?
Well, obviously, if there's selective enforcement, then it comes up in the whole viewpoint content-based discussion. And clearly the state loses. And, clearly.
The Highway Beautification Act violates the First Amendment, and the Highway Beautification Act violates Article 1, Section 8. Have you expressly set up an issue arguing that this was selective enforcement? I'm kind of interested in this selective enforcement. I thought you were saying... The only issues I saw you saying is that this was a violation of your free speech. I didn't see an issue saying it was unconstitutional because it was selective enforcement. You're not really arguing the selective enforcement issue here, are you?
I am saying it comes into play when you're measuring the content-based discrimination that we're arguing.
To the extent that you say what they're really doing is regulating speech because certain speech they allow and certain speech they don't.
That's right. And actually, in this case, certain speech they disliked. I mean, the TxDOT did not move to take down the sign until the sheriff complained about it. I mean, that's clear in the record. There's no doubt about that.
That's clear.
What we're getting at is if for some reason we disagreed with the Court of Appeals disposition and were to reverse on the First Amendment grounds, would there then be a remand to the Court of Appeals to address selective enforcement as a separate point? Or are you only asserting it in connection with the First Amendment claim?
No, you could do that, for sure. I mean, and certainly have that capability. I think that the issue is in front of you enough to look at because of the way we postured it. We didn't separate out and make equal protection sorts of arguments or anything like that, but argue that it was part of the animus that led to the content-based discrimination. And this is an as-applied case, too, that we're arguing. This is not the Court of Appeals hasn't invalidated the statute per se. It just said in this particular case, the way the statute was applied unconstitutionally.
Mr. Harrington, you've got the 11th Circuit, I think it was Union City, I think is the name of the case, looked at something like this and a similar ordinance and held that it was content neutral. How do you distinguish that case from this case?
In this case, I don't think you can. Well, as you know, you talked about Metro Media earlier, and the big debate that goes on in the court is this over-inclusive or under-inclusive. In Metro Media, for example, even though there was a 6-0 vote, or 6-3 vote, but there was 4 plurality, 2 concurrence, and the argument always is, can you actually have any exceptions without that actually being content-based? If you do have exceptions, are you really, therefore, distinguishing on the basis of content? And then if you do that, is that constitutionally permissible? In our case, I don't know where we actually fall out on the argument, because it goes both ways in Metro Media. The court goes both ways, but it still does form a 6-3 majority. Now, in our case, we're arguing that there is a content-based discrimination, number one, because it's not commercial and that's prohibited, but also when the state does open the door for political speech, it only opens it for its kind of political speech, and that can only be a campaign sign. So the state says, yeah, we do allow some political speech, but it's the state itself defines what the nature of that political speech is going to be. So there's a content-based distinction or discrimination that occurs there as well.
So because the Texas statute permits certain types of political speech for a narrow period of time, that distinguishes this case from Union City, I guess. I don't remember what the exact name of it. But that's that 11th Circuit case,
yes,
where they said this: as long as the sign ordinance limits the sign to activities on the property and not just commercial activities on the property, that is a content-neutral deal. You're saying this case, the Texas case, is distinguished from that case because in Texas we have a separate exception for political signs.
Yes, and you know, this also gives me a chance to make a point that it really kind of dawned on me today when I was listening to the argument. You know, in the Ladue case, which is the war in Iraq poster in the neighborhood, the court, that is residential. But what is interesting about that case, I reread it last night getting ready for today, and when you reread that, the court is actually kind of attaching the free speech right to property in a way that I hadn't really focused on before. And so it sort of has, in my view, a little bit greater vitality, I think, than what I had looked at or thought about when drafting the brief, is that it actually does, comes up in the context of the home, but it talks about property and how unique property is to personal expression, how different it is to have a billboard on your house or in your home or on your property than, the court says, to have some sort of painting, political painting on the factory. So there seems to be, to me, actually a nexus. When I first read the Court of Appeals opinion, I was a bit puzzled by the nexus that it was making with property. I thought that it was a little different than what I had briefed originally. But now that I go back and look at Ladue, as I did last night, I think actually that there is a closer nexus to property. And it calls it...
Time was on the individual's residence, on that property. Here, there's no way a motorist would know that the sign that they were seeing was barbers. I mean, there's no way to connect the two.
That's right, and that's exactly why in the beginning I thought that there was more of a distinction between Ledoux and this case. But when I actually went back and read it more carefully last night and looked at the court was talking about property, that actually the home was an example of property rather than being the only property.
That actually the home was an example.
And so I actually saw a closer nexus than I had seen before to it. And I think maybe that there is a certain free speech property right that does emerge more closely than what I had really given, I had looked at before. So I'm, anyway. So I believe that those are basically the comments that I have. And I'd like to point out again, I don't know I don't know where this mootness argument comes from today, but there is a real live $1,200 fine out there. Mr. Barber took down the sign because the judge told him in court to take it down. He went out the next day and took it down because she told him to. The order had not yet been signed, but he did it. And the question about federal funding constantly comes up, but they cannot ever show one single case where the federal government has moved against anybody for political speech. And
they recite places where the federal government has withdrawn funding for other violations of the
That's fact. Right. And it's and for commercial, and it's purely speculative that it would happen in this case. This case has been around now for 2, 3, 4 years. They could have easily gotten an opinion from the to strengthen their case. They raised this after the trial. They raised this for the first time on appeal. They could have easily gotten something from the federal government to say that's true or not true. They could have asked the government to come in as an amicus, anything. And actually, if you read the most recent petition that they've submitted, they've actually backed away from the strength of that argument that they've raised. But even assuming that this would cause problems with the federal government, deal with it as it comes up. There's no reason for this court to say we're not going to vindicate political speech because of some hypothetical problem that might come up in the future with the federal government. That can be worked out if, in fact, it would emerge. And the fact that there is nothing that they can put in front of you to show that it has ever emerged, I think, shows that you ought to discount the argument.
It seemed to me that there was a concession on the other side that if on this property there were a kiosk that were placed, I mean, something that cost really very little money, that further explained the reason for the sign, and you could pick up a copy of the Constitution or what have you, some document that that sign would be permissible under the Act. Are we really dancing on the head of a pin here? I mean, it's kind of easy to evade or to comply with the statute. I'm trying to find where, if we were to rule in your favor or in the other or in your opponent's favor, you could still, or Mr. Barber could still get around the statute pretty easily.
No, and not as easy as they make you think, Judge. First of all, it'd have to become commercial. No. And then he would have to get a he'd have to pay to get a license. And then he'd have to pay to get a permit.
To get a license.
In the state, our position is, and I think it's the position of our founders, is that you cannot burden political speech. This is classic political speech.
Well, let me ask you about that. Do we need to even address content neutral or content based? It doesn't appear to me that the Court of Appeals, although it set up the question under those parameters, and the briefing seems to be on those parameters, the Court of Appeals just seemed to say that's really irrelevant. If it's ideological speech on private property, nothing can regulate that. So do we even need to address content neutral?
I don't think you do. And I don't quite, I would maybe reshape the characterization you did of the court. I think what the court is saying is any blanket suppression of ideological speech is unconstitutional. I think that's what the court was saying. But I agree totally with you that I think the court is just saying, given the right, given free speech rights, given the nature of property rights in Texas, that you cannot totally ban ideological speech.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Judge. Thank you, members of the court.
Although this controversy has been around for 2 or 3 years, the sign has not. The sign was taken down long ago, so there was no problem along this throughway for the TxDOT to address at all.
commercial and non-commercial speech is treated equally here. Can you give me an example of non-commercial speech other than the campaign signs that would be permissible?
Sure. If there were something on the property, if there were a VA hospital and they put "Support Our Veterans," if there was a church, "Jesus is Lord."
But what about a private property owner?
A private property owner along this federal corridor could only put up a sign. There, I don't think that there is a political sign that they could put up that is related to an activity located on the property.
Any kind of non-commercial sign, other than a campaign sign during the 90-day period?
Not on that particular property, no. I would like to point out that on the record in page 499 is where the order is from the trial court dismissing the selective enforcement claim. It was not presented to the Court of Appeals, was not briefed, and is indeed moot. It hadn't been argued in this court because it was never brought up below. And the $1,200 is not a fine. The $1,200 is attorney's fees. And if the trial court was without jurisdiction, that order as well was moot and should be also vacated by this court. So there indeed would not be a fine there either.
If my house backs up to the interstate and my family and I say grace at every meal, I could put up a sign at the backyard over the interstate and say, "Jesus is Lord."
I think not, Your Honor.
But it's related to an activity that occurs on the property.
It is located. It is related to your beliefs, Your Honor, but it's not related to an activity that's conducted on the property.
It's an activity.
So, sign that said "Bridge Thursday nights."
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Bridge Thursday nights. Poker on Fridays? Or, I mean, really, couldn't you?
Yeah, exactly, Your Honor. That's why.
Poker on Fridays? I mean, really, couldn't you?
Yeah, exactly, Your Honor. That's if the court doesn't have any more questions, I'll waive the remainder of my time.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
I have one question of Mr. Harrington. Under the argument as you were finally making it about Ledoux, our holding would also at least suggest that the Federal Highway Beautification Act is unconstitutional under the First Amendment as well, would it not?
No, I don't think so, because
you're talking about the rights of a private. You ended up talking about blanket restrictions on private property, political speech on one's own private property, and the federal government rule would seem to prohibit that.
Well, we don't know that because it's never come up. And this is an applied case. I do not necessarily think that your ruling implicates the constitutionality of the federal statute, because I think you'd have to wait to see how the federal government treated it. As you know from the briefs, I believe is that there's actually an administrative process that they go through to determine whether or not there's been a violation of the act. And then if there is, then they give a warning to the state and so on and so forth. And the last step is if the state's not cooperative to remove the funding or curtail some of it. So this is an applied case. We don't know we don't know any situation where the federal government has ever moved under its own act in this regard. So I really wouldn't feel going. I would not go out on a limb and say that this statute reflects on how the federal government would enforce its statute.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the oral argument today on the court's special sitting in Amarillo. The marshal will now adjourn the court.
Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, now stands adjourned.